This is the Aston Martin Heritage Podcast with Gary Taylor.
So here we are at the parts distribution centre at Wolverton Mill. And around the table, we have Steve Waddenham, Des Lovett, Neil Grace and Stuart Lee. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Morning,
Gary.
Morning. It's a delight to be here. So we've got a lot to talk about. Not many people know about this parts distribution centre. I think when people think of Aston Martin, their facilities, they think of Gaydon and St. Athyn and something going on at Silverstone, wherever that is. But this place, it seems to be off the radar. So let's get it back on the radar. What is the parts distribution centre? Who wants to lead on that?
Right, well, I suppose I'm going to start off, Gary, because it's my fault we're all here anyway. And people are probably thinking, what's Wadders doing in the parts department? And many people know me from factory tours or from being a company historian, but way, way back at the beginning, this is where I joined the company. Not this actual building, but this department back in 1990. And I did my first 3 years in parts, and then I did a couple more chunks as well. So in total, I don't know how many years I've worked here, but probably 10 out of about 30, I suppose. But yes, it's a very special department, and one that many people probably don't really know even exists. And that's possibly inside as well as outside the company, really. It's tucked away in a corner of Milton Keynes. It's only a few miles away from Newport Pagnell, but it deliberately kind of blends into the sort of local area. There's no big sign out the front or anything. And it is basically a huge warehouse full of car parts, which are there for keeping our cars on the road, really. And from here, we buy and bring parts in, inspect them, package them, and send them out all over the world. And that's really what we're going to talk about today and how we do that. And also the lengths that we go to in order that we keep those parts available, really. And we've got parts here from basically DB4 right the way up to the current models. So as soon as a model goes into production, we've got parts here to support it, basically.
Okay, so I've got an interesting note here, and perhaps Stuart can pick up on this. We've got years of knowledge in the parts department. I mean, it's quite a staggering number. Do you want to say the number?
Yeah, so 586 years worth of knowledge in this building. Spent over the years. So what's that? You put out roughly about 10 years per person who work here.
I think we met somebody upstairs as we was walking through to the podcast. Somebody's been here for 53 years.
I mean, Des, obviously Des and that person between them have probably contributed a good 100 years.
Yeah, I think I'm up to 44.
44 years, yeah. I mean, it's legendary. There are people here in this department that we all know and love and are kind of like legends really within AML. Yes, it's a very loyal department. And 586 years, and that's between, is it 63 people?
Yeah.
So yeah, just correct. To kind of, if anyone's trying to do the maths on that. So it's incredibly knowledgeable as a department, really. And if people don't know what the answer is in here about a part-related item, then probably no one will know anywhere, really.
What sort of cars and what support do you offer here? We've got a list here of what you're actually up to today. So what does the parts department do today?
So we look after approximately 65,000 worth of parts that support the cars from DB4 up until DBX.
We support all the dealers all around the world, 160-odd dealers around the world. We have a parts bank within China where the parts come from us. We have one in America. In Kentucky, where again the parts come from us, they're packed, but it gives the dealers in China and America the extra ordering opportunity. They can get their things quicker.
You mentioned in somebody overseas sources there. I mean, in the recent world problems that we have you found that with Ukraine issues and currently the Red Sea, has that brought problems in supply of getting parts for yourselves?
I think more to it affected everybody with COVID, with the microchips problems that affected especially production, which then affected us because any parts that were available went to build the cars rather than coming to us. So that caused us a problem. There were some suppliers out in Ukraine, which again caused us and production problems, but they seem to be all sorted and everything at the moment seems to be flowing quite nicely.
But I think you're right, though, Gary. I mean, there's very few businesses at all at the moment that aren't affected in some way from all those various recent events. But you know, the thing is here, we try and not allow it to happen, to affect things too badly by being sort of well-planned for these things as much as we can. But and certainly having the parts centres in Kentucky and in China, that means that we just hold all the more likely parts that are going to be required that the dealers themselves wouldn't necessarily need to hold. So if you think about it, all your kind of things you need every day, the dealers have. Things that they're less likely to need, but they might need, we kind of keep locally. And then all the other stuff is then kept here, and then we feed those either directly to dealers or to the parts banks as and when we need to ship things out. So
it's an ever-expanding business, because each year Aston Martin makes 6,000 cars, whatever we're producing. That's 6,000 services. And we produced 6,000 cars the year before. So that's now 12,000. So each year it's expanding, because all of these cars need looking after, keeping on the road. And it doesn't matter what it is. We have pollen filter to a spark plug to an ignition coil. All of these cars need looking after. So we have to store the parts here.
That's interesting, because the new Vantage has just been announced. How far ahead do you get notice of this? Because you're going to have to start providing parts for that at some point, aren't you?
There's normally a bomb of material that comes out. So the first things that will come out are the serviceable items that those cars will need.
Right.
So there'll be brake pads, brake discs, calipers, windscreens. There's a whole raft of parts that are used every time we release a car. So we try and get in front here at Wolverton Mill. We try and get those parts on the shelf. So when the cars get out there to a customer, because it only takes a car to be going down a road and a stone hitting the windscreen, he needs, and the last thing he wants to do, he's got a brand new car and he can't get a windscreen.
Parts are on the shelf before the cars are going out to dealers.
Yeah.
Again,
okay.
That will be the serviceable items that they generally have to do. I mean, there's always the unexpected,
right?
Something that goes down, and then we have to get, as quick as possible, we contact either production, we'll get a part from production, or we'll contact the production supplier and we'll get it in.
Yeah. I do a lot of special order parts, seal plaques, keys, so I get the artwork quite far in advance, preparing for special order requests from day one.
And also as well, if we've got things like a DB12 suspension goes down, the production will buy that in as a complete corner unit. We can't get that individual part like a caliper. The whole corner unit will come over to Neil's workshop. Neil will then break that down, and we can service that part to the customer as an individual item. So what Neil does in his workshop is fantastic.
Yeah,
I mean, just to put this in a historical context as well. So first of all, there's always been a parts department at Aston Martin, you know, even from the right at the beginning. As soon as we started making cars, even if it was only a cupboard, you know, Lionel Martin would have set up a corner of the workshop and went, well, that's a parts department. You know, so you've always needed spare parts to service and fix cars with. And we know, I've seen, you know, invoices and letters and correspondence with Feltham, and I'm talking Victoria Road, pre-war Feltham, you know, so we know there was a parts department, quite a busy one by the looks of it, back in the 30s, and it would have been all the way through of all the various sites we've had. But the interesting thing is, until DB7 came along, in terms of what we're talking about now, the cars would go into production, and then it was expected that the parts required for those cars would almost be drawn off the factory floor, you know. So it was a little bit more hand-to-mouth back then. But when DB7 was being hatched back in the 90s, you know, we knew that we had to have parts at dealerships. And so that was my kind of break, really. I was a buyer, junior buyer, back in the early 90s. And they gave me the job of filling up the warehouse with parts for DB7. It was literally a shop. It was like sort of Arkwright's shop. You know, you walk in there, and a little counter and a bell on the door. And we used to keep we keep body panels in stock in those days for DB5 and 6. And we'd have a whole front end or a whole rear end. And if somebody came in and just wanted the front corner, we'd get the axle out and cut off, like get into a butcher's. You'd almost like go, well, where do you want it? And we'd literally cut off a corner and sell a corner, which is incredible, really. I mean, I don't know what we did the rest of it, but there were bits of you know, corners of cars dotted around on the shelves, really. So that's where it all started. And DB7 was much more serious. It's like, well, it's a
You needed to get a bit more professional with this.
And
now,
we went, if I remember rightly, we started in the May to get the parts on order, because at that point we'd had nothing ordered whatsoever for aftermarket. And by the sort of September, October, the warehouse was full of parts. And that was quite a big effort, because we'd never had that many new parts.
Is this the Newport Pagnell warehouse?
Yeah, this was when we were at Newport Pagnell, which we then outgrew because of DB7 and all the other models that followed it. And very quickly we outgrew the building. And that's when we moved everything up here in 2001, I think, Stuart.
There's various outbuildings in Newport as well. It wasn't just like the main building. There's outbuildings as well dotted around Newport Pagnell. So you literally jump in a van, it's on board the body side, and you go to Black Hole, or I can't remember the other one was called.
Yeah, but Clover Close and the Black Hole. The Black Hole was literally a big 1920s building with a curved roof, a little bit like the building we call Olympia, but it was skinnier, taller and longer. And it was really, really dark inside. It was so dark that even when you put the lights on, it barely made any difference. And the ceiling had all these little perforations in it where it had gone rusty. It was a metal, you know, tin kind of corrugated roof. And that's why it was called the Black Hole, because when you first walked in there, before you turned the lights on, if you looked up, the daylight would come through the roof, and it would be like looking in a planetarium. You know, there was all these little stars, and of course there were holes in the roof. So that was where we put things that never moved, really, really slow moving stuff. And I always remember seeing the front end for the Series 1 Lagonda, which is the model that we only made, seven of it at the time. And the front end that was up in the rafters was the parts for the 8th car, which then years later was finally built. But so we had a panel, you know, in stock for a car we'd only made 7 of. So clearly we weren't going to sell it in a hurry, you know. And that's back in the old days. It was very, very different to what it is now. Although even then it was computerised, but not the same sort of computers.
I was in production at that time when DB7 came out, because I worked on DB7 suspension. And we would supply the parts department with bits, but it'd be snuck across to us. It'd be a little, what we'd call a transfer document, would be put on my desk when I was they made sure I was out the office before they'd sneak it in, put it on the desk. And then I'd see this request for some parts for the parts department, and then I had to go grovelling for overtime to the production manager at the time so we could get the bits made for parts. And in fact, I did the last ever DB6 blocks, the last ever ones machined out the machine shop. I did them. That was Newport, but I actually got bribed with an Aston Martin T-shirt from the parts department to stay on and do one extra block.
Took
the bribe, yeah. Unfortunately, the T-shirt doesn't fit anymore.
when you said you did the DB6 block, what do you mean?
I machined it.
You machined it?
Yeah, machined it. So it went through several machines.
So that's where you started at Newport?
Yeah, I mean, if we do a brief history...
Yeah.
Say you have introduced us all, but I'm Des Lovett, and at the moment I work in quality for the parts department. But I started in 1976 as an apprentice machinist, and I did that till 1982, when I finished my apprenticeship at Aston Martin. Went through various spates of hard times and a lot of redundancies around that period, and I got made redundant, but I was only out a year. And I went back in 1983 and stayed in the machine shop area till about 2001, when I joined the parts department. And I was with Aston's then till sort of 2016. From 2016, it was a very short goodbye. I worked with Steve, actually. We did the factory tours for 9 months together.
It's quite funny, wasn't it? I phoned Des up and I went, Des, what are you doing? Can't leave at 39 years. He'd only done 39 years. I went, come on, mate, you need to make it 40 at least. And at the time, we were looking for somebody to come and do the factory tours on a sort of short-term basis. So you came back, didn't you?
Yeah.
Did another year and whatever
it was near enough, 9 to 10 months with you. And it was great, because not only did people like the knowledge of the old cars that we had, but we also had knowledge of the new cars. And it was nice to, I think Steve and I sold many a car to potential customers that came in just by the way we spoke to them and the knowledge that we had and making them enjoy their day. And it was a good experience. But after sort of a year, the parts department poached me back again then, and I did a few more years as a procurement engineer. And then with COVID coming along, I left for a little bit, and then I've been back now just over a year, but I'm running sort of quality here.
It's like a boomerang.
Are you boomerang?
It's like more leaving dues. even more than I have, actually, yeah. In that sense of it. But,
so I think in total now, we're sort of 44 years. We sort of worked it out. And hopefully this will see me out now. I'll do a few more years till I decide to retire. Maybe again,
and bring you back. The leaving presents must be very good.
Well, I did get a nice signed one. When I left production in 2016, a lot of the people here at the parts department signed it as well, because I'd been over to Gaydon. I was working in the quality over there, sort of end-of-line quality. So it was nice to get a nice, and I've still got it in the house, and it's up on the wall. It's in the lounge. I've got this nice picture of a DB6, and on the back of it is all that everyone's name is signed on the back, which is really nice.
We've got here your head of quality.
Well, I think that's an exaggeration.
All right.
I am the only one in quality.
did you type that then, head of quality?
No, I think that must have been Stuart. So I'm the quality controller for parts.
Okay.
But within parts, I mean, Steve is right. I mean, the history going back in parts, I remember back in parts when I first started, it was very much like Steve said. It was a very small sort of community, little offices. I always said we used to wrap things and then put a little ribbon on the top and a little kiss, and that package would be sent out to the customer. And at the same time, you had the shop where somebody could come in, and they have done, with a sort of briefcase full of money, and sort of put it on the top. Right, I want a water pump for me V8. I want a grill, and they'd pay cash over the counter. But, you know, that had to change because of just the size we were becoming with DB7 and DB9, the next generation on. We had to move. It was just we couldn't cope.
No, of course not.
Well, it's funny. I found an old internal AML news, or whatever it was called at the time, the old internal newspaper. And I found one, and it was from about a month or so after I first joined. So it's quite interesting because it gave you the numbers as it was at the time. And I think at the time there were 19 people in the department, and there were 16,000 parts on the shelf. And so we're just saying that we've now got 65,000 parts on there. But you think about all the models of cars that we've had over the years, really. And I think it said there were something like 43 dealers worldwide. Mm-hmm. So when you think, now we're under the 60-odd dealers. We needed the shop in those days because there were certain countries where there wasn't a dealership, but there'd be a car. So somebody would come over from another country on holiday, and they'd pop in and buy parts for their DB5 and wrap them up and take them home again. And the amount of times I've seen people wrapping things up to put in suitcases to take back home, but when in the days when we had the shop, because that was it was all part of the service. And also that, you know, demand for us and the you know, the expectation level was very different in the 90s. So before DB7, our cars were, even the new ones, were normally part of a large, you know, fleet of cars that the owner would have. So they weren't everyday cars, and they weren't expected to be using them every day. So things were a bit more relaxed, and if somebody needed something and we didn't have it, they'd be quite happy to wait for it. And also we'd shut down. We'd have all car factories have shut down. So normally in the summer, the whole car industry goes on holiday for 2 weeks at the same time, which is why the holidays always cost more in that usually last week of July, first week of August. So the old factory fortnight. But so did the parts department. So if you needed a part for your car, you just used to have to phone up and leave a message on the answer phone in the days when we used to have the ones with the tape recorders, and we'd get back to you 2 weeks later. You know, that's we can't even imagine that. We're sort of almost running shifts here nowadays to keep the flow of parts going, because we're dealing with people around the world. But, you know, go back 30 years ago, we were literally put clothes sign up, and the only members of staff in the building were those that were coming in to do maintenance work. So we'd be asked if we wanted to work during the shutdown, which then meant you could take your 2 weeks whenever you wanted. So we used to volunteer for it. And what we would do is come in and we'd paint the floors, or we'd move one load of shelving from one part to the other. So all the jobs you couldn't really do in the normal business year, we would do in those shutdown weeks. And yeah, and that's what we did. But you can't imagine having a major car company just closing everything down for 2 weeks.
So this department now is open virtually all year. We have Boxing Day, Christmas Day, and maybe New Year's Day off. And then we get volunteers to come in over the Christmas period because, like Steve says, not all dealers celebrate Christmas and others are working, so they need their parts for their cars. So we have a limited staff come in, which keeps cover going over the Christmas period as well.
6 to 6.
Yeah, so we're open quite. I mean, the business starts at 6 in the morning and goes till 6 at night. A lot of that is to help getting the parts picked, ready for the packers to come in at 8 o'clock, and they start packing. And then we have the lorries that are due to go out. They have to leave at a certain period of time if they get into airports or if it's going by road. So it's a very active business that's going all the time.
Yeah, I think that's the other thing as well about the warehouse. This warehouse is, what's the correct terminology for it? It's effectively your airside, aren't you? Once you go through the door,
yes,
everybody signs in and out.
We're a known consigner.
There you go.
Status, which means that we've got priority when we go to airports. We don't have to go through the X-ray system because the people within this building are known people. We all sit. If you work within the warehouse environment, we all sit and have to do a test. We have to follow certain rules. It's a 3-hour test. You have to watch all the videos and understand. And this is all about things that get into aeroplanes and potentially can cause explosions or just general disarray within an airport facility. So we know the people that are in our building. It's restricted access within our building. And that keeps us on the good side of the Civil Aviation Authority.
So you can put some in a box and then send it anywhere in the world, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. We average send out about 1,100 lines per day worldwide.
That's a lot, isn't it?
It's a heck of a lot, considering we're 300 lines at Newport Pagnell when I first joined there.
Where's your major customer now? Is it still UK?
UK is one of the biggest ones. Europe. Very big, followed by America, then China. China's growing very big, hence they've got like 3,000 parts lines in their distribution centre over there.
Yeah.
Helps support their parts.
Of course, their part lines won't go back as far as a lot of the other car lines, because obviously China, we only came on with China a few years ago. So they won't have DB4, 5s and 6 and the V8 range, the old Newport Pagnell V8 range. They're more the more modern cars.
So okay. The V8 range is
the V8, yeah. So that was slightly different.
So how far do you go back? Because I got the impression you pretty much started from DB4 onwards, but do you deal with pre-war?
Not really. There's too many specialists out there
that
can look after this.
So we're looking from DB4 onwards.
Yeah, I mean, Curatelli are really the pre-war parts most people go to. And then we've got our friend Anthony Forshaw and his team of people at Aston Service Dorset, and they look after the post-war Feltham car. So that's really kind of, you know, DB2 up to DB4, because technically a DB4 is classed as a Feltham car. And that all comes down to where the seat of power was really at the time. And so until DB5, headquarters was actually at Feltham. So that's why that was all lumped together many years ago. And Anthony's family bought the rights and all the parts at the time for those cars, and they've done a very good job keeping them available ever since. So we deal with Anthony. Anthony deals with us. We deal with him. And it's a really kind of happy relationship. Really got our friends at the Curatelli with the pre-war, Anthony with the Feltham, and then we look after everything else, really.
How do you classify the cars in your own mind? Perhaps you don't do any classification, because at the Heritage Trust, we're always struggling. We have the Batelli area, we have the Feltham, we have the Newport Pagnell, we have the Bloxham. Then we move into the Gade and the VH cars. Then we move into the second century. Do you have any classifications in your mind?
I think we're very much the same as you guys at the Heritage. You know, we look at it, the pre-war, and then we've got our heritage ones. DB4 up to Vanquish, and then the VH.
So Vanquish, the Newport Pagnell Vanquish. So that's Vanquish. In your mind, that's the heritage side of things, and that includes DB7.
The VH platform, which started at DB9, up to again Vanquish and Vantage, and then you're onto the newer generation, which then started with DB11.
Yeah.
So we've got all those. We're very similar to yourselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
It breaks my heart when you say Vanquish is heritage.
It is.
I built them. 40 last year, and I started there when I was 17. Yeah.
What did you do there?
I started on the. I started in 2001. I started to build the Vanquish. I was on station 1500 with Kenny Clark.
Yeah,
a little shout out to Kenny there.
Yeah, Kenny's.
I'm sure many people remember his name.
Yeah,
I was there for like 2 or 3 years. Then I moved to Gaydon for the DB9 launch. Same 2 or 3 years there. Then I come to Wolverton Mill. Yeah, to hear Des say Vanquish is heritage, I'm not that old, am I? What's happening?
Well, it's because, when I left the machine shop after all those years in the machine shop, so I ended up sort of running the machine shop, engine shop, harness room and tool room. Then I moved on to production engineering. And my section was on Vanquish. It was when the tub went onto the marriage fixture. And then from the marriage fixture, we lifted it off onto a trolley. And that was my section. So how that all happened and how it was built, didn't have to do the marriage fixture, but I had to come up with the lifting gear, how to lift the car, the tub, onto the marriage fixture, and then when it was connected to the chassis, to lift it from there over onto another trolley. And having worked in a machine shop all those years, it was like someone saying to me, well, we want you to make a nuclear weapon. Not a clue where to start, And we got it done, and it all worked,
And that was like an overhead.
Overhead gantry, yes. Yeah. It was always caused like a big bed frame that we had, and then we connected it. Once it hooked onto the tub and lifted the tub up, and then when the tub was connected on the marriage fixture, you connected to the wheel nuts, studs. Yeah. And then we lifted the whole frame up and down onto another trolley. Then at that point, wheels were fitted.
So for people listening, if you can visualise it, with a Vanquish, the back half of the, from the bulkhead to the boot, so imagine if you got a Vanquish and chopped the front wings off, that whole section painted and everything else, that was the tub, as you call it, but it's really like the body shell. And then that has to be lifted up, lowered onto a big kind of jig.
Yeah, marriage fixture. And what you did then is the engine was brought in, and the whole lot, the front end, was bolted to the tub.
Yeah. So the engine sat on a cradle, which had bolted up to the bulkhead. Yeah. And then once that was in place, you then bonded the front nose cone crash structure into the front suspension upright.
So it's bringing back memories now?
It is, yeah.
What was your part? You said you'd...
I worked just off the marriage station, so it get lifted down, back onto the trolley, which we had to manually push from station to station. So to then go to Gaydon, where everything's automated, it was so different.
But so did you join Newport Pagnell at Vanquish? She wasn't involved in...
Yeah, I was waiting around for the first 2 weeks to see the first body top come on the line. And then there was... it could only have been about 10 of us, I think, on the line. There was no tools because it was the start of Vanquish. And the first tub come online, all the tools were brought to us, and it was like everyone sort of like jumped on it just to be able to do something. It was to see where we are now, it's crazy.
Been unusual really when you think back to that period. There was the last of the V8 cars ahead of them going through the final stages of rectification and, getting ready to sign them off and send them out. And then you had the decorators behind them painting everything, and then the Vanquishes coming up behind them.
It was 14 hours each station, so two full days really to do our work. And then we went to Gabe, I think it was 27 minutes.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking, there can't be many car manufacturers that went through this production shift. You think from the hand-built V8 cars to Vanquish, that was a leap.
Mm.
Then, Neil, as you said, then you went from Vanquish to Gaydon, if you like. That was totally automated. Mm-hmm. I know we had DB7 in the mix somewhere. Aston Martin did seem to go through these leaps, didn't they?
Even Gaydon, I'd use the word automated quite loosely because, of course, they're still hand-built.
Of course.
But the car, the difference being the cars were on a moving track, even though the track doesn't move the whole time, it only moves on an index basis. So it would move, like as Neil said, every 27 minutes or whatever the time is now.
It was getting people in. When I remember one of the managers, Mike Cantello, when he came from Peugeot, and he couldn't get his head around the fact that a car would be outside the office. He'd go home, that same car would be outside the office. He'd go home, that same car would be outside the office. It never moved.
No.
But there was people working on it all the time, that different people would come and do different things. And then finally, after about 3 days, it'd move along a little bit.
Yeah. But, you know, with Newport Pagnell V8 era, those cars were 3 or 4 months to build. And then, so it was a lightning quick to make a Vanquish in 6 weeks, which is where we got to eventually. But as you were saying, to start with, it was equally a long period of time per car, because nobody had ever made one before. Not only had nobody ever made a Vanquish before, nobody ever made a car like a Vanquish before. So we were, as a business, we were like forging ahead with new technology, bonding aluminium and carbon fibre together. So yeah, those first cars that were really truly hand built bit by bit as we were learning how to build them, and then of course straight into production. And I think by the end of 2001 we were certainly moving the line every 6 hours, and then I think it went down to about 4, but it never got any quicker than that. I mean Newport Pagnell was always
there was still an element of hand built. So panels came in, Superform panels, but they still had to have a panel beater turn the flanges over.
Growing the passion, sharing the stories. The Aston Martin Heritage Podcast.
We've just invested, I think it's about £500,000 in three big Kardex machines. So the floor space it's going to create will allow us to put other racking in, or maybe other Kardex machines in when these are up and running. So
what's a Kardex?
Kardex machine is a big roller machine. So basically it's lots of shelves. We've got two of them that are sort of vertical against the wall. And we've got a third one, which looks absolutely huge.
It's in Europe.
It's a big, yeah. So that will just hold hundreds and hundreds of shelf boxes. We type it in on a computer what part number we want, and the box is presented to us. And I think over time, when the systems are all integrated, orders will be downloaded to these machines, and it will automatically bring the things to the picker. And all they'll do is take the parts out of the box, press another button, away it goes, and it'll find another one. But you'll see the space it's created. So the Wolverton Mill is sectioned at the moment. You'll see it when you walk around. It's WS, WM, WL. It's quite simple. Wolverton small, Wolverton medium, Wolverton large. So there's very technical no words there. But so what we're hoping to do is we will lose all of WS. We will lose, I think, all but one rack of WM. So all of the products that are currently in those shelves that you'll see out there will go into these new machines.
So it's like a big revolving cupboard effect.
Revolving cupboard, yeah. So dead right, Steve.
Upright machine, and inside it's a big revolving
carousel.
Carousel, there you go.
Yeah.
And then you press the button and it brings it down.
So they've only just been installed. They're still sort of, people are still learning. We haven't actually put product in them yet. I think that's very close to that's going to start happening.
What do you do with old stock, or, you know, something that's from a different era? You think it's just not shifting, it's taking a lot of space up. You know, what do you just hang on to it in case somebody rings up and they do need it? So that's all you can do, really, isn't it?
Well, I mean, basically, I think that's really what Stuart, big part of what Stuart does is reviewing the items in stock, the heritage items, and things that don't move very regularly. You know, we have to balance with, you know, what we hold and create space for new parts, and obviously have to manage it quite carefully. And I know in my previous role, I worked in the same role that Stuart's in now, and we would review that every so often, and we would then offer items to our heritage parts specialists. So there's a group of those people out there. Check our website, you'll be able to find out who exactly they are. But it's people like RS Williams and Aston Engineering, HWM, Chilton Aston. Stuart can rattle them all off, I'm sure. Works, obviously, Aston Martin Works. So they would they would look at the list and go, right, well, we've got a car coming through that we're restoring, and those parts would be useful. So every now and again, we would offer parts out, and they would either speculate and think, right, we'll have those and we'll probably use them ourselves, or, you know, there's an immediate use for them.
Which we try and keep within what Steve's saying. We also try and keep, we have got an awful lot of samples we try and keep just in case we have to reproduce these in the future. Sometimes you'll find we don't have drawings because Aston's, with its eras, all the life it's had, didn't always make it all its own stuff. We bought some proprietary parts in, and we did make an awful lot, as I can testify from the machine shop days, but there are things we bought in, so we try and keep a sample, and you'll find we don't always have the drawings, but on that as well, we have got an awful lot of drawings as well.
Yeah, I know there was a part recently someone contacted me about, because although I don't really work here anymore in the parts department, I try and work with these guys, and people come to me when they've got a problem with an older car. And there was an item recently where it was keeping a car off the road, in a car over in North America, and we had one part. So with the part it needed, we only had one, and that part was protected so that we didn't sell the last one and then not have anything left to be able to use as a sample. But in the end, we looked at it, and Stuart agreed to effectively sell the part to the dealership that was repairing the car, and then the old damaged part came back, and that is now the pattern, because we didn't need the part to work for in order for us to copy it.
We move into a recondition side of the business, and that's quite a successful side of the business. We do that with engines for customers.
Yeah, what you do, yeah, it, isn't it?
Neil does an awful lot of
ECU reprogramming, Vanquish instrument packs, DB7. We'll see him later, I'm sure.
Yeah.
We do a lot of that, yeah.
We're working with technology as well that goes back beyond 1994 when the DB7 first came out, with electronic control units. So that's like pre that. Neil's got a machine there, you'll see again. Next door goes back to 1985.
Windows 1985.
The technology we use.
It's more louvers than windows. These are the company's specific one.
Yeah.
So you'll see it. It's a bit of science.
Yeah. So the units we got in Neil programs, they're like one-offs of the company. If something goes wrong with those, so Neil has to maintain those and keep on top of them.
Of course, yes.
We do our best to support all the cars. It's really difficult. You do get, having worked in heritage, you do get to a stage where, yes, you could make something, but it's going to be so expensive, no one would buy it. So you have to always bear that in mind, you know, how expensive a product would be to reproduce for the volume of cars that you're going to sell it to. It's a difficult balancing act.
It's a huge challenge, really, is the fact that, you know, you might have a part that, say, a DB7, where there was, say, 1,000 cars a year being built. So that particular part you bought 1,000 of, but then all these years later, that part doesn't really fail very often. And once you've used up any leftover stock that was there from the end of production, when you then go to reorder it, you might only want 5 of them.
Yeah.
And that's a very difficult conversation to have with someone when you say, well, we only want 5. And then normally they'll say, what, 500? And you go, no, 5. You know, so you can imagine the economies of scales are very tricky. And I hear the feedback when I go out and talk to people about older cars, and often the conversation goes to spare parts. And I know it is difficult, but there are an awful lot of challenges that we've got to overcome. Most car companies will have a policy where they will support a model until the last car they built of that model is 10 years old. And then normally they'll just kind of let it drift away. And especially nowadays, you know, if you think about cars that were around 10 years ago, and then start wondering when the last time we actually saw one of those cars, you know, the cars just kind of get recycled, don't they, almost? So other car makers don't have the same challenge that we have, because the really old cars that they made, they no longer really look after. And those cars, if any survive, are looked after by owners' clubs and specialists that, you know, that have handfuls of new old stock. But with our cars, they don't die. I mean, 95% of everything we've ever made is still around. You know, and that's why the other companies we mentioned earlier do very well, because they're looking after pre-war cars and early 50s cars. But we then have to look after everything else. And however many, you know, 1990s Virages there were last year, there could be more this year because one or two cars may have been dragged out of barns and restored. So actually our survival numbers go up rather than down.
with some of our cars, it sounds a bit strange, but some of the older cars are easier to look after because you've got the specialist out there, people, ex-Aston, you know, we can get a panel made for a DB4, DB5,
DB6. Yeah, that's easier than making a carbon fibre panel.
Making a carbon fibre panel for one of the later cars is more difficult because they were done within a production environment and people, like Steve was saying, don't want to set up for five.
But that said, you know, we've seen this coming so that we hold a lot more panels in stock for those type of cars. So don't worry if you're listening and thinking they've got no rear wings from a whatever it is, because we have. But that's the reason why we've had to think long term. How many of these are we likely to need? And then we've obviously had to make decisions to put those things in the stock. But yeah, certainly the older parts in older cars were made out of metal, so you could turn them up and machine them or whatever. But once you get into 1990s electronics and things, that's when all the problems start, and that's when we have to be a bit more resourceful. And sometimes it's a case of getting a part remanufactured electronically that may look different inside because things have moved on and microchips are different, but providing it does the same function. And sometimes you can install that in the casing of an original part, but the internal parts, guts of it, if you like, are more up to date. So there are ways around things, but it is very challenging, isn't it, really?
Yeah, and Steve just touched on a good point there. The technology leap over the years, how we could get something rapid prototype now or scanned that wasn't available when I first started in this job, you know, back in 2001. You know, now to be able to scan something, get a pretty good reproduction off of that, and then get that rapid prototyped.
Yeah, you know, 3D printing.
3D print is just unbelievable.
Things that didn't exist in the old days, but yeah.
People listening to this, they think, great, I'd like to get myself I'm going to pop into Wolverton Mill. I'm going to get myself a head gasket for my Cygnet. That's not going to happen, is it?
No, unfortunately, no. So you have to go through your main dealers or specialists.
Right.
So, you know, you could walk into a main dealer anywhere in the world and order any part that we've got here. So if you've got a DB5 and you live in Luxembourg, you'd pop into the dealership and you could buy a part for that car through that dealership.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, you know, certain parts of the world, they might not see DB5s very often, but that's when we've got the technical support people here to help the parts manager at the dealership, wherever that is. And then again, we all of us around this room, we've all done that over the years and helped people out that have never dealt with the car in front of them before. But that's what we're here for. And again, that's a little bit different. I think most car makers nowadays, it's all evidence completely digital, and you can't ring up and just talk to a parts person, but you can at Aston Martin. That is something we still do, and that is a service we provide to the dealer, and then the dealer obviously provides that service to the owner of the car.
Perfect. Right, let's wrap this part of the podcast up. Let's have a walk around the warehouse and see if I can sneak anything out. All right.
Yeah.
See you in a bit. So Neil, we are in a very cold room, in a corner of the warehouse. So bizarrely, this is called a wiper room. Can you explain to this?
Yeah, it's a room with no windows, no heating, as you can probably tell.
But they really don't like you here, do they?
I know. That's what happens.
The tap doesn't work, Steve.
So this is where I assemble all our wiper motors, from Vantage V8 to Zagato DBS Rapide. So this is where a supplier can no longer support us. So then that's when I'll step in. We'll get all the equipment and parts brought over to us. And then we'll find a process and a way of building it up, because we might only want to supply maybe one of these a year rather than 5,000 or 6,000. So it's easier to do it on site, me on my own, than try and get 6,000 made somewhere else.
The supplier on this was even though they couldn't support us anymore, were very good. They taught me how to do it all. I was able to film it, process, document it, which I was able to pass to Neil.
And as you say, at the time, you'd need 3,000 or 4,000 a year, and now you're just down to...
Every once in a blue moon.
You can't imagine those sailing, but when they do, you need one, don't you?
Fortunately, they don't fail very often, which is good.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for that, Neil. just moved further along through the facilities, and we are in the, well, what it's called to be the famous archive room. Why is it famous, Steve?
Well, yeah, this is the parts department archive room, effectively. And in here, we've got original wooden drawing cabinets where all the, these are literally from Newport Pagnell. And in those drawers, we've got all the parts drawings for many of the parts that are in the warehouse. And you can see that one's got DB7 written on it. So that's DB7 drawings. There's also, it's basically like a large room. You have to take some photos in a little while. Yeah, let's pull one open. Yeah. So in there, you've got like sort of rolled up drawings. Now, obviously, these are quite recent drawings because they're for DB7. The drawings that are in this room, the oldest ones I've ever seen in here go back to 1948, but most of them are from 1960, sort of three onwards. Okay. Each individual part will be drawn, and these are the master copies of those drawings.
Okay.
I think we've also got machines in here that can scan the drawings and then digitise them. So. Yeah.
So we've got the scanner machine just here, which can scan up to anything up to A1. Not the A3. We also have a microfilm scanning machine as well, and approximately we've got 50,000 microfilms to scan, which have all the data on it for the parts.
Also, you can send that drawing digitally to a supplier to get it made as well. So, okay. Rather than sending a rolled up, I mean, in the old days, you know, we'd request a drawing, a copy, and they would be effectively photocopied, and we'd have them put on our desk, and we'd send them off in the post to a supplier. So pre emails, you know, back in the 90s, when I was a buyer back in those days, so you had to physically get copies of the drawings and then post them out. The other side of the room, we've got the sort of tall shelf units, and those are master samples of all the technical publications we've ever had. So in the old days, you used to get a parts book, which was a big lever arch folder type book. You'd have workshop manuals. You'd also have service scheduling books as well, where it would tell you how many hours for each job to service a car. Handbooks. So we've got got a copy of every handbook we've ever printed. And so in the days of when cars came with a printed handbook, really. And that goes right the way up until VH era cars.
It's nice, isn't it?
So this is actually a paint sample. But in the days when people bought cars, ordered, I'd say this is a DB6 one. So you've got a silhouette of a DB6, and then you've got the various body colours that you could flick through, put the silhouette over. Got a handful of these left. These are all DB6 ones, actually, but we've got other similar lever swatches. And, anything with this years ago would have been old stock that we've kept. And it's just been kept in here ever since. And they're just valuable things to have, really.
Okay.
So this is an artwork drawer. And these are the original pictures that appear in the handbooks or workshop manuals. So in the days of the old-fashioned printing, these are the original master picture. I've just opened the drawer randomly and pulled out a beautiful picture of a DBS, a 1960s DBS. And then there's one here, which is the actual... DB5 shield badge artwork, which is pretty amazing, isn't it? When you look at that, I mean, imagine if that went to auction, what that would be worth. Beautiful thing, isn't it? But in this room is just full of information and things that we use to supply parts with or to answer technical questions on cars, really.
Neil, we're at a DB7 instrument pack, workstation. Is that the correct phrase?
Yeah, 100% is. This is the workshop, so this is where I'm predominantly based. I've been in here for about 8 years on my own. I have round about, I think there's 900 individual jobs. Now, it is a lot, of course, but it can be anything from simple cutting a length of a door seal, so maybe cutting a meter wire, anything to DB5, DB6 headlamp bezel assemblies, DBX. I do log on to water pumps, DB6 water pumps. Every model that we've done that we still service, I can do in here. But as you say, we're here at the DB7 Speedo programmer. And you can see there's one on there now just doing its thing. So I can get special order requests from dealers. where they've got a faulty pack, and they can request the specific mileage which is already on the dealer, the customer's car. So, for example, it could be 100,000 miles. So I'll get a fresh pack from stock, put it on this old instrument pack jig, run it up, and we can do about 300 mile an hour. Now, obviously, 100,000 miles, we can't do that in a day.
No.
We can't do that in a week. So it can take up to 3 months to program one single pack.
You want to get the mileage spot on again for the owner. You're doing it under miles, because that won't be right. So I guess during the last hour or so, you're watching it to press the stop button, are you?
I'm sitting here with my eyes fixed to it. So I just want to hit that magical requested mileage, and it cannot go over. So for the last hour, I just stare at it, and as soon as we hit it, switch off, we're good to go. Get it packed up. Then the next day, hopefully, it can be at the dealer.
So you're not just supplying original parts. You can offer some personalised details, can't you?
Yeah, personalisation is quite a big thing on our cars. So every Aston, or the later generation Astons, will have door sill plates, hand-built in England, hand-built in Great Britain. And you can personalise them with your name, your family crest. You can even have your signature on there.
Oh, really?
So I'll just get a special order for a Vanquish, for example, hand-built in England for Gary Taylor. So I'll personalise on the PC the name and the car, send it through to our laser machine, and you can probably hear the background. Yeah, we've got one going now. So actually, the one we've just finished is done.
Already?
Only takes a couple of minutes, and you can see in there now. So we've got a lovely hand-built in England for Gary Taylor.
Look at that.
You can add your family crest, even have his signature. In the past, we've had celebrity signatures.
Just the machine while it's...
personalisation is a really big thing on these cars.
We mentioned earlier that you can offer some personalisation, signage, etc. But one of the other things is that perhaps if a car's going through some sort of restoration, it would like a nice new chassis plate, for example, because it probably look a bit ropey. And you do that sort of thing here, yeah?
Yeah, that's correct. So, like you said, the final stage of the restoration is having a VIN plate put onto the vehicle. So we get the request sent from the dealer. It's verified and checked that everything's okay with the car. Make sure engine numbers and VIN numbers tally up. Request is sent down to Neil. And then Neil does his magic with stamping the VIN plates up.
So what if it's a private restoration? Somebody's been doing it themselves. They've done all the hard work, and they come to you and said, I want a chassis plate 1, 2, 3 for this. And then do you have to go through other verifications? How do you prove it?
It's all done through the dealership. So we don't deal with the independents. So we deal with the dealer.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And then they do certain checks with the police, make sure nothing's been stolen, make sure they've got a copy of the old VIN plate if it's with the car. If it's not, then we have to do further checks.
I'm standing outside something. Well, when you look through the glass, it looks something like from a science fiction film, and the picture will be on the website. So what is this thing we're looking at? So
this is the VBM machine. It's the biggest one in Europe. It's £500,000 worth of investment. It will increase productivity within the PDC up by 40%, and it stores up to approximately 75,000 parts if it's held out to its max.
It's a scary looking and almost beautiful looking machine as well, isn't it? So how do you access the parts?
That's around the front of the building of the machine here. So we'll go around there.
Should we go around there now? Yeah, so let's just walk away around there. It looks like it's a huge building in itself, isn't it?
Yes, it's massive, absolutely massive. And onto the right hand side here, we've got two more.
All right, okay.
Each one of these, they can store 15,000 parts.
Because I remember when we sat down for the interview, we discussed it, and I said, Aston Martin producing more cars, more models are coming out. You're going to need more bigger premises, and you were hesitant on answering that. And I could see that, well, with these sort of investments, so it looks like you are going to cope with it.
Definitely, yeah. We'll save the best for last. Hesitant for a reason.
Reason. Just by the entrance, and some trucks have turned up with items. But every item, or near every item, is checked for quality control before they go in. Is that the case?
Not always the case. We sort of pick and select what we need to select. If they're trusted suppliers, if the supplier is approved by production, they go straight through and they go to what we call in-gate, which is the ready to be put away into the warehouse. we have different problems to production. Quite often production will get a right and a left hand in, it goes onto the line, the guys pick it up, they know exactly which is right and left hand. Where when we're sending individual parts all the way around the world, we've got to make sure the right hand is the right hand and the left hand is the left hand. So we do have various items that come into inspection which are completely different to production. But also we fall into line with production. If production says something's got to be inspected, then we also inspect it as well for various reasons. It could be for they've found that they're getting constant defects, so we look at it as 100% inspection, to a hole being a different size. There's varying reasons why something comes to inspection. In parts, I see a lot of the old parts, a lot of the, so I'm reading imperial drawings, which might be a bit difficult for a lot of people, but for me, it just comes natural. In fact, if anything, it's a bit of a struggle with metric for me, but I do go across between the two. So, and I spent many years at Newport Pagnell, like machining items on CNC machines, where we programmed in metric off an imperial drawing. And so we had to do it both ways round.
Steve, Aston Martins, well, they need tyres, and we've just seen a very long rack of tyres.
Yeah, and that adds to every year. We've currently got roughly 350 different types of wheel in stock, and this time next year that'll be more because there'll be new models with new wheel options. So if you think about it, every new model nowadays, there's a number of wheels. There's a standard wheel, and then there's the optional wheels, winter wheels and tyres. So every time anything new comes out, that's another line we have to carry here. So there are literally hundreds of different types of wheels. So 350 at the minute, that'll grow and grow. Nothing comes off the other end. So we don't sort of say, right, well, we haven't made those for 10 years. We won't do wheels for that model anymore. It just literally grows and grows and grows. And the same with tyres. You've got summer tyres, winter tyres, different size tyres. And also, just while we're talking about tyres, it's worth pointing out to anybody listening that, you know, we often hear people saying, oh, yeah, you know, the other day I drove my car and the back end kind of felt like it was going to break away. Have you looked at your tyres? And it isn't about the tread depth. Quite often people will say, yeah, I've checked my tyres and they've got loads of tread left on them. But how old are they? And that's the key thing, because the rubber changes over a period of time and it's really noticeable on a performance car. So the rubber changes grip, basically. So if ever you think your car doesn't seem to be handling quite as well as it did, look at your tyres. And if you don't know how to check the dates, take it to a dealer and get them to look at them and just tell you how old your tyres are, basically.
So we're getting towards the end of the Wolverton Mill tour. And Steve Waddenham, we have lost. I think he's gone off to sneak some parts out to build his own car. But so while we're here, Des, Neil and Stuart, thank you for your time and input.
No, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, T.
No, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Discover more about the story of Aston Martin, the cars, the people, the history with the Aston Martin Heritage Trust. You're always welcome to visit us at our museum in Oxfordshire, so find out more via amht.org.uk.